Today is Wednesday, April 10th, 2019. It is 10:30 a.m., and this is panel number 2202, entitled The New Age of DACA and Birthright Citizenship. My name is Violeta Chapin, and I'm a law professor here at the University of Colorado Law School. I teach an immigration clinic, and students in my clinic represent non-citizens charged with a variety of different immigration matters here in Boulder. To my immediate left, Miriam Jordan is a national correspondent for the New York Times, and in December of 2018, she began uncovering and reporting about the fact that President Trump employs undocumented immigrants at his golf resort. Her most recent article, published in the New York Times just yesterday, details how undocumented immigrants who have been working for as long as a decade at the president's golf course near Mar-a-Lago, Trump National Jupiter, are just now quietly being purged from the payroll and dismissed. To her left, Ana Cabrera is a correspondent with CNN who has covered the DACA program extensively under both President Obama and now Trump. She has personally interviewed many DACA recipients about their reactions to congressional negotiations around the border wall and DACA since the election of Donald Trump, reporting on some of the most pressing immigration issues of the day. Professor Ming Chen teaches immigration law here at Colorado Law and is one of the leading scholars in the areas of immigration, race, and civil rights law. Her most recent book project hopes to advance a conversation about immigration and citizenship that includes the goal of integrating new members of our citizenry alongside immigration enforcement. John Eastman is currently working on a book about birthright citizenship in this country. He urges that we revisit our common interpretation of the 14th Amendment, which permits anyone born in the U.S. to automatically be granted citizenship. Specifically, he argues that the subject to the jurisdiction provision of the 14th Amendment must require something in addition to mere birth on U.S. soil. I'll now invite each of the participants to provide us with some introductory remarks, asking you to limit those to 5 minutes, please. After that, I'll give each of you the chance to respond to any remarks you heard up here, and then I will open it up to questions from the audience. I will keep the cue from my laptop and from cards being circulated in the audience. Let's go down the line for your introductory remarks here, beginning with Ms. Jordan.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. It's really a great break from my crazy life these days. It seems that immigration is the issue for this president, and he just does not stop giving. So I thought I would speak a little bit about DACA, this deferred action for childhood arrivals program, through my work, because I've been writing about it since its inception. And, since its early days in 2012, the young people who've benefited from the program have seen their hopes alternatively elevated and dashed, sometimes in the space of a single week. President Trump canceled the program, some judges revived it, politicians negotiated deals to save it, but everything is still up in the air. How nerve-wracking has it been for these people? So through this chronology and my work, I'll read some snippets to you that kind of illuminate the situation. So this is from August 2012, and I wrote, "Armed with foreign birth certificates, school records, and proof they have grown up in the U.S., tens of thousands of young undocumented immigrants across the country apply to a program that could allow them to remain in the country and work legally. I'm ready for my life to change," said Luis Garcia, 27 years old, of Mexico, who had been standing more than two hours in a line that wrapped around the block in Los Angeles at a Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights organization. Another student, a 21-year-old son of a gardener, had arrived at Sunrise. "So many opportunities are going to open up now," said the Mexican college student, who boasts a 3.95 GPA and hopes to study law. Nearly 2 million immigrants could benefit from DACA, which had begun accepting applications in that August of 2012. The program had been announced by President Barack Obama in June, and it was considered the biggest development in immigration policy since 1986, when Ronald Reagan convinced Congress to pass an amnesty that benefited 3 million undocumented immigrants. Beneficiaries of DACA get a Social Security number. However, they don't get a green card or permanent legal residency that would put them on the path to U.S. citizenship. DACA participants have to reapply every 2 years. Critics of illegal immigration say the program is tantamount to amnesty and will mean more competition for scarce jobs. Others say the president is pandering to Latino voters in an election year. So that's where it stood then. In 2012, in October, wrote kind of an explainer about how DACA came to be, the rise of dreamers, right, those who benefit from DACA, who, you know, were a major force pushing for this change. They basically lobbied with Obama's aides. They visited Washington. These were students from California, Florida, who wanted to become, part of America. As Gabby Pacheco, one of them, told me, we wanted the freedom to be everyday Americans. They campaigned for 2 years using marches, sit-ins, mobilizing volunteers, and occasionally clashing over their techniques. But ultimately, they won this new policy, right? 2 years renewable reprieve from deportation and a work permit. It was a big deal. Then we come fast forward to 2016 campaign and 2017. Suddenly, Jessica Rojas, who beat poverty to put herself through engineering college, is concerned she may not be able to, after all, work and participate in the United States economy because Mr. Trump has been pondering and publicly agonizing over what to do about the program since he took office. The Justice Department, which is responsible for defending DACA, was at the time led by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who, as many others in this administration, is now no more. But that September, Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinds the program and completely throws these 800,000 or so immigrants who have this, what some call amnesty life, on this roller coaster. So that happens, it's canceled, but then we had a spate of lawsuits opposing the rescission, and ultimately a judge announces or decides that the government could not simply rescind DACA, and at the least, for the time being, it has to allow those who already have DACA to renew. But no more new DACA applications were allowed. So this story I wrote with a colleague in January of last year, the first day that people could now renew again. So there's, again, this kind of rush to go to these, you know, resource centers that would help these students file these applications. So, these people, you know, on the first day, young immigrants were able to renew the permits, giving them a temporary protection from deportation as ordered by a California district court. You know, dozens of them were lining up before the crack of dawn outside the Legal Aid Society of New York. I had to take my chance. You know, I had to do this. You know, even if they rescinded, it's a worthwhile investment, these people were telling me. You know, the Department of Justice, hours later, filed a notice of appeal on that for that decision, wanting to take it to the Supreme Court, which has not actually arrived at, as far as I know. So, in any event, where we stand now is that, you know, Trump, in January, while I was in San Antonio, Texas, and he said that San Antonio, by the way, has a wall that has kept out undocumented immigrants, even, you know, in any event, while I was there, he offered, in exchange for $5.7 billion to erect a barrier along the border with Mexico, he would agree to revive DACA in its original form for 3 years for the 800,000 immigrants, because DACA is still kind of, you know, on the balance, hanging in the balance. So he said that was the deal he wanted to make, and I decided to ask some people who had DACA what they thought of it. And I went into, like, this strip mall in San Antonio and, you know, stopped a number of people. And at this point, like, they just shrugged. They're like, I have DACA. I don't know what will happen. I'm just living my life. And I think that's where we're at now. I mean, it's been such a roller coaster for the beneficiaries. There are now attempts in Congress to, make the DACA recipients or Dreamers whole and maybe put them on the path to actual citizenship. But if it doesn't happen this year, it's definitely not going to happen in 2020, which is an election year, as we all know.
Thank you, Ms. Jordan.
Hello, and thank you so much for taking the time to come today, especially given the weather. I'm so honored to be in front of all of you. Colorado is home for me. I grew up in Denver and Littleton. My parents still live here in Colorado. They're in Longmont, so just outside of Boulder here, and this is really special to be able to come home and participate in such a wonderful event in which so many thought leaders are here and able to share their perspectives and insights and expertise. I've reported on the immigration issue for many years. In my current role at CNN as the anchor of CNN Newsroom Primetime on the weekends, we've talked a lot about the immigration issue because it has been so prominent in this administration and with this president. It has really been his issue, the issue of immigration. And as a journalist, I think it's really, really important to get different perspectives on this issue because there is this great debate. But most importantly, I think it's extremely essential for our viewers to know what the facts are on the issue of immigration. And DACA recipients in particular are people there's not much debate about, to be honest with you. 83% of Americans, the majority of Republicans, Independents, and Democrats all believe that people who are qualified to be DACA recipients deserve to stay in this country and that they're contributing in this country. I think the bigger divide right now is over what's happening at the border currently, and the president likes to highlight that. So let me just bring you some of the latest information about what is happening at the border right now. We know that based on numbers just out yesterday in the month of March, there was a big surge in immigrants crossing the southern border. They made nearly 100,000 apprehensions, which is the most in one single month that they've seen in terms of illegal border crossing since 2008. So there is a surge in people coming to the United States. We also know that the majority of those people, according to the government officials, the CBP, the DHS officials that are reporting these numbers, majority of them are families and unaccompanied minors, and they're fleeing violence, poverty, and dire circumstances in their home countries. The majority of them are from the Northern Triangle, from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. And so they're seeking, many of them are seeking asylum here in the U.S., which they have the legal right to do. And not all of them will receive that. In fact, about 85% of the people who come and seek asylum the legal way are rejected. So that process has to play out through the legal system here in the U.S. that's set up. We also know that there is a situation in which people who are coming into this country, there's a backup. There is a problem with the way the system is currently structured, and I think Democrats and Republicans agree with that. I've talked to a lot of lawmakers on my show. I've talked to a lot of law enforcement on my show. I've talked to a lot of families who've been directly impacted by immigration, whether they are immigrants themselves, whether they are DACA recipients, or whether they are families who have loved ones who've been killed by MS-13, and that is an issue as well. So I think that there are slivers of truth to all these stories, but the bigger picture here is immigrants are coming to this country and they're contributing to this country. Let me give you just a few of the facts when it comes to the contributions of immigrants at large, and then briefly about DACA recipients. We know that immigrants participate in the U.S. labor force at a slightly higher rate than native-born Americans. We know immigrants are more likely to own businesses than native-born Americans. We know immigrants have started more than half of America's startup companies valued at $1 billion or more. And we know since 2008, at least 85 Americans have won the Nobel Peace Prize, or the Nobel Prize, I should say, not Peace Prize necessarily, but the Nobel Prize, and about a third of them have been immigrants. And so that just is a reminder that this is a country based on immigration, and all of us come from somewhere and have come to this country seeking opportunity, perhaps seeking that American dream. We know DACA recipients are some of the cream of the crop, so to speak. They have to qualify in order to receive their special status. They are given background checks. They have to be educated or enrolled in school seeking an education. They have to have, or have served in the U.S. military. And we know that 75% of DACA recipients are currently employed here in the U.S. They have provided more than $2 billion in state and local taxes, so they're contributing to the economy that way. We also know, according to economists and those who have studied the impact of immigrants in this country, that in 5 years, according to Zandi, the GDP would be $105 billion smaller without DACA recipients than with them, $105 billion. So there are all kinds of reasons for supporting DACA recipients, and it comes back to it's not really something that's being debated except for perhaps like the very hardliners on the right who believe, you know, maybe there shouldn't be any legal immigration. And that's a completely different discussion. But when it comes to DACA recipients, it's still baffling to think that, you know, what we see in Capitol Hill in Washington, that they can't get anything done on this issue of immigration reform when there really is such common ground on some of these issues in particular. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes, but we don't know yet.
Thank you.
Morning, everyone. My name is Ming-Siu Chen, and I'm a professor at the University of Colorado in the law school. It's nice to exit the building and to enter the broader main campus and to be able to connect with the rest of the community. So thank you for all coming here today. I wanted to start by commenting on the title of our panel, which is that this is the new age of DACA and birthright citizenship. And the panel idea gave me some pause about the idea of what is new. And I think it has always been the case that the United States has been committed to some form of immigration enforcement. Even during times of active nation building, there's always been an element of enforcement that comes with defining what a nation is. What I think is new is the extent and the scope of expanding enforcement under the current administration. And just to connect the panelists that we've had so far, what we've talked about in this idea of expanding enforcement and the narrowing of the boundaries of membership is a narrowing at the border for asylum seekers seeking their first entry to the United States, narrowing for DACA recipients who are perhaps the children of undocumented immigrants born outside the country but living functionally their entire life inside the United States. And what I would add to that in the topic of birthright citizenship is that the continuum is now reaching to those who are children of undocumented immigrants who are born in the United States, which is to say, just so the point is not missed, because I think sometimes people can be a little too broad and sloppy on what's actually a very critical point. In focusing on birthright citizenship, we're not talking about DACA. We're actually talking about the opposite. We are talking about U.S. citizens. Right? We are talking about the U.S.-born children of immigrants who are born in the United States, living in the United States, and as a matter of formal law, are U.S. citizens. And that's the extent to which the enforcement strategy and the narrow of the definition of membership has expanded. It's expanded to the point where in the proverbial message of the canary in the coal mine, right, that we need to look out for moments where the weakest individuals are at risk. Essentially, it's not just the canaries that are showing us the risk to the miners. It's the miners themselves that are now under attack. And I would say that what connects these different policies is the fact that we're now looking at an attack on citizenship itself, and not just the non-citizens who show us the outer boundaries of what citizenship means. Just to give a few examples to anchor that, and I know my co-panelist, Professor Eastman, has also been studying birthright citizenship. I did want to, just put out a few of the anchors in talking about birthright citizenship. Again, because one thing about birthright citizenship is the 14th Amendment still exists. That hasn't changed. So this is one where we're talking more about proposals for change as opposed to a policy that has already changed. But under the 14th Amendment, the language says that all persons who are born or naturalized in the United States and who are subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state where they reside. That comes in the language of the Constitution, that remains in the language of the Constitution, and it has been interpreted by numerous Supreme Court decisions. I will pause for a moment just to say that I actually think most of the debate about birthright citizenship is actually not a legal debate. I think it's mostly a political debate and a rhetorical debate about, again, how we want to draw those boundaries of membership. But that said, because I'm a law professor on the panel, I do want to remind the audience of the constitutional source of birthright citizenship and the lineage of cases that have repeatedly interpreted and upheld that basic principle in the 14th Amendment. I won't go through all the history. I don't actually know where I am. I'm okay. But what I'll remind you of is that the 14th Amendment had a context, right? The 14th Amendment came into play directly to overrule the Supreme Court decision, Dred Scott. Dred Scott was a decision that was brought, Dred Scott was a decision that was brought to respond to the situation of the children of freed slaves in the South. And in the particular case, the Supreme Court ruled that the child of a freed slave who was born in the United States was not a citizen of the United States, that birthright citizenship did not extend to this circumstance. That was the specific case that the 14th Amendment, in this particular provision that I've quoted to you, was trying to overturn. Right? So in understanding the context of the 14th Amendment, it was contemplating the same situation we are dealing with today, which is individuals born in the United States on U.S. soil with all the formal entitlements of citizenship who are nonetheless trying to be excluded from that citizenship boundary. Right? And so following the 14th Amendment, the pivotal case in interpreting birthright citizenship has been a case that came out of the context of Chinese exclusion in the 1800s. That case is named Wong Kim Ark. And that case, as a legal matter, was pretty straightforward. With the 14th Amendment on the books, the court decided that a child of legal permanent resident immigrants in the United States who happened to be of Chinese heritage, that child born in the U.S. was, in fact, a birthright citizen. If you connect the dots, it's not that hard, right? You had Dred Scott, the 14th Amendment overturned it, and Wong Kim Ark said, we have the 14th Amendment. So a birthright citizen is a birthright citizen, and the heritage of their parents doesn't matter, right? So that is the lineage of cases, and I could certainly talk more about the details of it as we get a chance to respond to one another, but what I would gesture to is that a number of the proposals to change birthright citizenship didn't begin with the Trump administration. There have been decades of proposals by representatives such as Steve King in Congress to change the language of the 14th Amendment, either through a congressional amendment or through a legislative act. Those proposals have floated around for, I would say, at least 20 years. I don't remember the exact first year. So those proposals have been around, but they've taken a new level of notice under the current administration, with President Trump in a TV interview announcing that he would contemplate trying to change that through executive order. So the line, in my mind, is from Dred Scott to President Trump in trying to challenge the boundary around birthright citizenship. Thank you.
So I guess I'm supposed to be the opposing voice on the panel, and I'll try and uphold my end. First, let me talk about DACA. I don't want to get into the policy thing. I think the policy arguments that have been made make perfect sense. And if, in fact, overwhelming majorities of Americans support granting lawful status to the children of illegal immigrants who have been here for a long time, then that's great. The question is, who has the legal authority to do that? And my contention is it is not the president unilaterally. It is Congress, which has plenary power over immigration. So the question we need to look at in a nation devoted to the rule of law is, was the DACA and DAPA program, which were not implemented even by executive order, but merely by guidance memos issued by the Secretary of Homeland Security, is that the legal route to provide this entitlement of DACA? Now, the legal memo that came out in support of DAPA, the second program, that was ultimately held to be illegal by the courts, rested exclusively on the idea of prosecutorial discretion. We can decide not to prosecute certain individuals, or in the immigration context, not to deport them. That's an executive function. But it went beyond that, and it provided legal entitlements to work authorization, to Social Security cards and benefits and what have you. And even the general counsel at the INS during the Clinton administration acknowledged that prosecutorial discretion cannot extend so far as to provide a change of status or benefits. That's no longer prosecutorial discretion. That's a rewriting of the legal regime, which the president, no president, has any authority to do. Even the question on whether prosecutorial discretion can extend as far as a categorical change in the law, which is what DACA did. Anybody that met the eligibility criteria was not then assessed on whether we would use prosecutorial discretion on a case-by-case basis in this particular instance. But if you met the criteria that Secretary Napolitano set out in her memo, you automatically got the deferred action under DACA. That's a categorical suspension of the law, which arguably runs afoul of the president's duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The Supreme Court has suggested that on several occasions, never held it, and it's, you know, in all candor, I think when the court would eventually get presented with this issue, they would probably rule that that's a not jurisdictional for them. They can't resolve it because they don't know how much discretion, how little enforcement would account for a categorical suspension of the law. And so I think they would probably defer to the executive on that. But what I'm fairly confident they would not defer to the executive is the additional piece of giving out benefits, work authorization, Social Security cards, without any statutory authority. In fact, directly contrary to the statutory authority that existed. A deferred action does not allow somebody to get a lawful work authorization. And the forms themselves said at the bottom on every application, no change in status is reflected by this, no individual rights are incurred, it can be revoked at any time. I think as a matter of the rule of law, that's right. Now, if as a matter of policy, Congress wants to change the law on that, it can. But until it does, what President Obama did with the DACA and DAPA programs violated the law. And do we really want an executive who can just rewrite the laws at his whim? You know, maybe you thought yes when Obama was president, and maybe you think no now when Trump is president. I'll speak briefly about the litigation. The most interesting aspect of the litigation is the one filed by former Secretary Napolitano, now chairman of the Board of Regents of the University of California. She argued that Trump or Jeff Sessions' revocation of DACA was illegal because it didn't go through the notice and comment rulemaking required by the Administrative Procedures Act. This is particularly funny to me because the original memo issued by the same Secretary Napolitano did not go through the Administrative Procedures Act. And so she violated the Administrative Procedures Act, and she's now arguing that it's locked in and you can't revoke my illegal action without going through the Administrative Procedures Act. That's a little disingenuous, it seems to me. So policy aside, and I think there are very strong policy arguments in favor of DACA. Legally, that has to come out of Congress, not out of the executive that has no statutory authority for it. Now let me turn to birthright citizenship. My interest in this case goes all the way back to shortly after the 9/11 attacks on the United States. A few years after that, there was a guy named Yasser Issam Hamdi who was captured on the battlefields in Afghanistan, transferred ultimately to Guantanamo Bay, and when they discovered that he'd been born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that's part of the United States. I know it's French, but, you know, they started treating him as a citizen. And his dad was here on a 2-year work visa, working on an oil rig for Exxon off the coast of Louisiana. I've got a copy of his birth certificate. He's born in the mother's hospital in Baton Rouge. There, he got that birth certificate. The question is the mere birth on U.S. soil to somebody who is temporarily visiting here sufficient to confer automatic citizenship as mandated by the 14th Amendment? And if you look at the historical record, the answer to that is no, pretty clearly. The 14th Amendment's language, which Professor Chen read, has two components, born on U.S. soil and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. The question is, what does that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, mean? Now, modernly, we think if you're subject to the jurisdiction of the courts or the Federal Trade Commission or whatever, you're subject to the laws, they can hold you to their regulations and all that. Our modern understanding of that phrase is merely subject to the laws. But at the time the language was written, it had two different meanings. Were you subject to the complete jurisdiction, such as you owe allegiance to the country, or were you subject to what they called the partial or territorial jurisdiction, such that you had to comply with the laws while in the country, but you were not more broadly subject to the jurisdiction of that sovereign? Think of it this way. A British citizen comes over on a tourist visa and visits. Which side of the road do they drive on? If they want to stay safe, they drive on the right side of the road, not the left side of the road, like they do over in England, right? Right? They're subject to our laws while here. They're subject to our partial or territorial jurisdiction. But they're not subject to our allegiance. They're not subject to the jurisdiction in the more complete sense. We don't draft them into our army. We don't prosecute them for treason if they take up arms against us, although we might charge them with other crimes. They owe no allegiance. They're not part of our sovereignty, our body politic. So the question is, which of those two meanings of that phrase did they intend when they wrote the 14th Amendment? We don't have to speculate about that. Native Americans, we didn't have a question of illegal immigration at the time. We were still trying to populate the western lands and have as much immigration as we could. But we did have a question about what would be the status of Native Americans under this new statute. And the authors of the language were asked point blank. The Indians, that was the word they used, the Indians were most clearly subject to our military and civil jurisdiction. Are you going to make citizens of them? And Senator Lyman Trumbull, who was the principal sponsor of the 14th Amendment, and Senator Howard both said no. They are not subject to the complete jurisdiction. They are only subject to a derivative jurisdiction. And that what we mean by this is the complete jurisdiction. The original Supreme Court cases in Slaughterhouse says the same thing. Of course, it does not extend to the children of diplomats or any foreign national while visiting in the United States. So the question is, have we interpreted that language more broadly than was intended? And if so, restoring the original meaning of the Constitution puts the ability back in Congress to decide how far above that constitutional floor, as a matter of good policy, we ought to go. In other words, I don't think the 14th Amendment took that large plenary power of Congress to decide how much immigration to allow away from them. That's what the legal or constitutional fight is about. And, I suspect there's a new case, and I'll close with this. Hoda Muthana, who was born the child of a diplomat, the question was whether her dad had renounced his diplomatic status before she was born and after. But the court seems inclined to accept the plaintiff's argument that it was when the dad lost his status, not when the State Department was notified it. And she was born in between the two points, which means the Department of Justice, I think, is going to be forced to argue Trump's position, which is subject to the jurisdiction does not extend to the children of temporary visitors. Quite apart from whether they're here legally or illegally, temporary sojourners were not part of the subject to the jurisdiction in the complete sense intended by the 14th Amendment. And I suspect the Supreme Court has never ruled directly on this. As Ming pointed out, the Wong Kim Ark case dealt with lawful permanent residents, not temporary visitors. There's never been a Supreme Court holding on it, and I suspect we're close to having a case that will decide that question.
Thank you, Professor Eastman. I'll invite our panelists now if they choose to respond to anything you heard just now.
Since we're already on the subject of birthright citizenship, I thought I could respond briefly to that and then briefly and narrowly to DACA. So on the issue of birthright citizenship, the analogy to Hamdi, I think, is an interesting one. The phrase has been used sometimes. Professor Eastman used probably the more respectful one about sojourners and how sojourners are not the intent, the intended beneficiary of the 14th Amendment Citizenship Clause. What I think the slightly more pejorative version of that has been called a reluctance to have drive-by citizenship, right? This idea that one can make a brief stop on U.S. soil and therein guarantee the citizenship of that person's life and likely the children who come thereafter. What I would point out, though, is that I think there are a few critical differences between Hamdi and the proposals that are being floated today, which do come out of a social context. And I think that current social context is an important one to remember and to not conflate with whatever the original meaning might have been, although I do think there is some continuity there, like I said, the origins being Dred Scott. I think the contemporary context, those proposals have been mostly given to try to limit the permanent membership of undocumented immigrants and their families in the United States. It's to cut off the possibility that an undocumented immigrant who has made a life inside the United States that includes U.S. citizen children can continue under the formal guarantees that are given to any other U.S.-born citizen. That is not drive-by citizenship. These are individuals who are claiming and have already made a life for themselves and their children in the United States. As I said, the U.S.-born child of an undocumented immigrant is not an immigrant. It is a citizen. That is very different from this idea of a sojourner or drive-by citizenship. Also, part of the issue with Hamdi was he claimed to be an enemy combatant. I think that is highly different in terms of the political rhetoric we're talking about in the groups that we're trying to exclude. And a really brief note on DACA. There's so much more we could say about this. This is something that I have written about pretty extensively. But I would point out that I think some of the strongest objections that Professor Eastman raised and that probably were some of the strongest objections in the Supreme Court when they heard the Texas versus United States case in oral argument were not so much the ability of the executive to defer removal. Prosecutorial discretion is a longstanding practice. The application of it, the formalization of it, was somewhat new. But the practice of prosecutorial discretion was not new. Most of the fight, I think, as a legal matter, is about this issue of benefits. But I think that fight can be quickly resolved. If what we mean by benefits is something like the work permit, that piece did not come through the looser guidance process. The guidance piece is codified in the regulations of CF 4274, which is an interpretation of a 1980s statute, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, passed, again, in the 1980s under Republican leadership with largely bipartisan support. And then it was a regulation to interpret that provision that did go through the notice and comment procedures of the Administrative Procedure Act. So it's fine to argue about benefits that aren't provided in regulation. That's a big debate we're having even outside of immigration law in other areas of how the government functions and works. It doesn't happen to apply to the work benefit portion in DACA.
Thank you, Professor Chen. Any other responses from our panelists?
I'll just add one thing. I have obviously not the level of expertise on the law as these two, so I've been enjoying going to class this morning and learning a little bit more about some of those pieces. But I do know on, you know, your argument, Professor, about the illegality or the legality, perhaps, of how the Trump administration has gone about trying to rescind DACA. That has been taken before the federal court, which has said that it was unconstitutional in the way this administration tried to rescind it. And, of course, that could be appealed, and so the litigation continues. But as somebody who's not a legal scholar personally, I defer to those who are practicing law in order to answer the question about whether or not it was legal and how it was rescinded. And so I just want to at least throw that out there in terms of the other side of the legal argument.
So I'll begin with a question from the audience, and this is for the journalists in the room. When the news regarding rolling back the 14th Amendment and birthright citizenship came out, the media suggested that the constitutionality of birthright citizenship was not settled, stating that there was another and valid side when, as we've heard, this was settled in the Wong Kim Ark case. Can you please discuss the potential failure of the media in this issue?
I honestly don't know what that would be. I'm not familiar with what they're referring to specifically.
I'm sorry.
I can take it up, though. Look, Wong Kim Ark dealt with lawful permanent residence. The court 42 times in the opinion talks about the legal domicile of Wong Kim Ark's parents. There's a lot of language beyond that in the court opinion, but the legal phrase for that is dicta because it was not necessary to the judgment. So the notion that the Supreme Court has already settled the question of whether the children of temporary visitors, as opposed to lawful permanent residents, are automatically citizens under the 14th Amendment. That's not true. The Supreme Court has never addressed, much less settled, that question. And I think that's what the media, the more honest parts of the media, were focusing on. And scholars on both sides of the aisle have recognized Wong Kim Ark's actual holding dealt with lawful permanent residents. And I'll give you some proof of why that was the more limited understanding of it. If Wong Kim Ark stood for the proposition that anybody born on U.S. soil was automatically a citizen, no matter what the status of their parents, temporary or permanent, lawful or unlawfully present in the United States, then we would not have had the series of offers of citizenship in the 1920s to various Native American tribes or more globally. We would not have had guest worker program in the 1920s that ended with a rather dramatic repatriation movement after the Great Depression. Lots of children who had been born here without once ever having the issue raised that they were citizens being repatriated back to their parents' home country. None of that happened. It didn't even happen all the way up through the Braceras program in the 1950s. So this notion that Wong Kim Ark settled the question is of relatively new vintage. It was certainly not understood as settling the question back then and for decades afterwards.
I mean, I could just briefly comment that in terms of whether or not the question is settled, I think there's one way in which you can say something is unsettled, which is to say that there's a live and active debate about the issue. In that manner, I don't think the application of the 14th Amendment's Birthright Citizenship Clause to, again, the intended targets of this rollback is controversial. There's a different way that is a more technical manner of saying that an issue is not settled, which is to say that those exact facts have not been presented to the U.S. Supreme Court. That is true. I would concede that. These exact facts have not been tested. But I don't think that means that that the law is as unstable as being suggested. What I would remind everybody in the room of is, and you know, I am a law professor. I do have some priors in this issue. I believe in institutions. I believe that there are processes for changing the law. If that is what proponents of a change want, I do think it would be a change, and the process that is laid out would be a congressional amendment, which requires a supermajority of Congress and ratification of, I think it's 2/3 of the state. So if that's the process that our elected officials want to pursue, that is a valid process for doing this. What I take objection with in the media coverage was that there was a huge skip over the fact that the mechanism that was being proposed by President Trump was the use of executive order, which is quite different from both a congressional act and a change to the Constitution. I mean, Professor Eastman and I were having a friendly chat before the panel about the Electoral Congress, about the Electoral College as the mechanism that we use to elect a sitting president, right? And the fact that somebody did not win the popular vote, but nonetheless won the majority of the Electoral College for now means that the person is the valid winner under the election system that we have. If people want to change that system, they can do so, and I would actually encourage that they do so. But for now, for someone who believes that one of the only grounds that we might have for a shared consensus is the laws that we've already all agreed to, I think you have to start with the laws we have, and I think the laws we have extend birthright citizenship.
Well, I mean, but that turns on a meaning of subject to the jurisdiction that is different than those that wrote it and ratified it intended. So by that reasoning, if the Supreme Court in Wong Kim Ark changed the meaning of the 14th Amendment to say anybody born on U.S. soil, no matter the circumstances, that was a change without a constitutional amendment. I fully agree that if subject to the jurisdiction means simply subject to the laws, and the only people excluded from it are the children of diplomats, then it would take a constitutional amendment to change the idea of birthright citizenship. But if I'm right about what the 14th Amendment actually means, then the Supreme Court had no more authority to change it than any president. And so what we've got to do is roll up the sleeves and figure out what the language actually meant. And I think the historical record on that is compelling, that it did not mean temporary jurisdiction. It meant complete jurisdiction.
Will the panelists please address the question of the legality and or morality of deporting the parents of a native-born child, especially those of young age? Do we actually deport American citizens?
Oh. So, you know, years ago, I get this question a lot, and I came up with an analogy. I live in Southern California right near Disneyland. And I imagined the hypothetical, a father decides to take his 8-year-old daughter down to Disneyland, and he gets there, and he realizes the ticket price is $100, not $50 like he thought, and he doesn't have enough money to buy two tickets. So he buys one ticket for his 8-year-old daughter and sends her in by herself, and then he goes around the corner and climbs the wall to try to join her because he doesn't want the 8-year-old roaming around Disneyland all by herself. And he's caught by the security guards at Disneyland, and he's sent back outside the wall of Disneyland. Now, he leaves his daughter there by himself, by herself. Was that the security guard's fault, or was it his fault? All right? Now, if he then takes her with him, has the security guard deported her, or has he decided to keep his family intact? And isn't that the question we have? If somebody who is here unlawfully present in the United States, and let's accept the notion that a child is born here and is a citizen. Let's accept that for a moment, despite my arguments to the contrary. And the parents are deported because they are not lawfully present here. And they decide to take the child back with them so as not to separate the family. Have we deported the child? I don't think so. Right? And there's a reason for that. The family is making the decision, and if there's another relative in the country that they decide they want to leave the 8-year-old with, instead of taking them back to their home country of Guatemala or wherever, or Russia or wherever, that's their personal decision. Our law has not deported that child if the child goes back with the parent, nor has our law separated the parents from the child if the parents decide to leave the child here.
I was just going to add onto that. I'm not aware of any cases or stories that have been reported in the news in which a U.S. citizen was deported. But I do know of many cases in which, you know, the parents are in this legal limbo and they came here. And in fact, one family I profiled here in the Denver area was a DACA recipient. His name's Angel Oaxaca Rivas. And his parents came here when he, I believe, was a toddler, and he's lived here ever since. And he, when I did this story, was a couple of years ago, was a college student at Regis University and was studying to be a doctor and was a recipient of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program and was thriving and was concerned about, you know, the status of his family because he had two American siblings who were younger than him, were born here in the U.S. And so the question is. I mean, that's one of the debates, right, in terms of the morality of this legal debate as well, is, you know, should those parents be allowed to have a pathway to citizenship when, you know, much of their family is already either American citizens or it's all they've ever known. This is a country that they've known. They don't know their native country at all. And so I think that's one of the discussions that is happening when it comes to policy. Of course, DAPA was an executive order that President Obama passed that has since been defeated. And so DACA has been resilient, but DAPA not so much. And I'll just add, you know, there's also the question about whether people who have served in the armed forces for the United States and yet aren't citizens themselves, should they be given some kind of status? And so there are cases, too, in which undocumented citizens who've gone on to fight for the U.S. have been deported. And so that's just another, I guess, layer to this conversation and what also makes much of the immigration system complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this comparison to the Disneyland child and Karen is a little, I'm sorry to use the word trite, but I mean, to compare that to a family that, you know, might be separated not just by land, but by years, as a result of a parent being deported. I think it's less about who is to blame. And at this point, you know, we have 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country, the majority of whom have lived here for more than a decade and have American-born children. I mean, is this what we want to do as a country? Is to deport the parents, break up these families, and have these American citizen children feeling the not only being left behind and whatever emotional, psychologic, economic toll that takes on them, but just also as citizens of the country and the resentment that it builds. I mean, I have been quite surprised by the fact that I interview children of undocumented immigrants in places like Ohio, and they are playing basketball and, you know, kind of, you know, calling themselves LeBron James and, clearly, you know, cheering for the big football team in town. But then when I ask them, you know, how do you feel? Who are you? In some shape or form, they'll tell me I'm Mexican when they're American. And why? Because that's what people call me. They call me Mexican. And my parents are Mexican, and people don't like them here. So there's this whole identity question, too, that's connected to this that I think that, you know, we as a country have to consider in terms of, you know, going forward and how we deal with this undocumented mass of people and whether in some way to rectify their status or not.
I'll tell you as an immigration attorney that there is a defense to removal for undocumented immigrants that have been here a certain amount of time that have U.S.-born citizen children. The law requires them to meet a very high standard of proving exceptional and extremely unusual hardship to the child should their undocumented parent be deported. It's not enough that the child would be, of course, traumatized and left alone without their parent. They have to literally be potentially dying of some terrible degenerative bone disease or something like that. In order to meet that standard, it's a very difficult standard to meet. So when undocumented parents, many of whom have no criminal convictions whatsoever, have been living in the United States for decades, have U.S. citizens born children, have U.S. citizen children born here, are then deported, they are given the choice. Are you going to take those children with you, or are you going to leave them here, either in the care of a relative who may not have legal status themselves, or, you know, burden social services with that? Many of them have to make that decision, right, to take them back. The truth of the matter, though, is those U.S. citizen children can always come back. And the question is whether or not we're going to look short-term and be punitive, or long-term. Right? Because if they go away to another country like El Salvador, where my family is from, for example, and I love El Salvador, but I don't want to live in El Salvador, right? For a number of reasons, is that their educational outcomes, their health outcomes are not going to be as good. And then when they come back many years later, what are the ramifications for our society then? So we do need to look at all of the sort of the long term as well. A question from the audience. Hopeful immigrants from Norway seem to have an easy path, while immigrants from Mexico, Central America, India, and Southeast Asia face severe challenges. Would the panel address the potential racial elements of today's immigration debate?
Are we talking about undocumented?
I could say something.
Sure.
Yes. I think there is a racial dimension to today's immigration debate, so thank you, whoever asked the question, for putting that front and center. I think that can't be denied. Having said that, full stop, I think that one thing that is really interesting to me in the research I've been doing for my book on immigrant integration during this age of enforcement is, again, that canary in the coal mine metaphor, right? It's this idea that, for example, in response, how would I say this most succinctly? I think the threat to immigrants has always been rooted in a deep form of institutional racism. I think that continues to be true today. That said, there's a second piece I want to add that to me underscores, again, what is new about the policies we're addressing on this panel, and that is that I think it extends beyond the Mexican and Southeast Asian, and I'm trying to remember the other examples from the question. I think it extends to Norway. I think it extends to white, highly educated, high-skilled immigrants on legal visas in the United States. And what I have found in my research with, at this point, more than 120 immigrants of various legal statuses all over the state of Colorado is that even white Canadian tech workers on H-1Bs are feeling nervous about their safety, status, and security in the United States in the wake of things like the travel ban, which for at least the first 48 hours, given that it was issued by executive order, was not accompanied by guidance, let alone notice and comment regulations, there was a brief moment where it was unclear whether green card holders would be excluded from, would be considered safe from the travel ban. You know, and the quote that I heard again and again in these interviews was about how this was a big wake-up call to those who thought they might have previously been immune on the basis of race or on the basis of being a legal immigrant.
And I think one of the things that's also just to throw out there, not talked about so much, but is one of the big debates currently and one of the reasons that immigration reform at large hasn't happened is the question about legal immigration. And so kind of if you strip away where specifically people are coming from, but it does seem that, you know, the current administration has focused on immigrants that are coming across the southern border, and obviously there's a racial component to that in terms of where they're from specifically. And, you know, for what it's worth, a lot of the people who are currently undocumented in the U.S. didn't come across the southern border. They came by airport, and they had visas of some sort when they came, and they overstayed their visas, and so now they're here and don't have a pathway into the legal system. That aside, there is a question about, you know, who should be allowed to be here. Should there be a merit-based approach in terms of who's allowed to the U.S. and what does what means what value do people have, right? And so what gives you some kind of merit in order to get into the system? And that can apply to whether you're from Central America or whether you're from Norway. And right now there is a group in Congress that wants to limit legal immigration. You know, a lot of people will say, well, can't people just come here the legal way? It's not that simple, and that's part of the problem. It's not very simple for people, regardless of where they're from, to get in the legal way. It can take many, many years. And one of the aspects that has been wanting, that some people want to scale back, is the opportunity for people who maybe have some kind of legal status here in the U.S. to sponsor family members to come to the U.S. And again, that would impact immigrants from anywhere. And, you know, should people be allowed, if they have legal status, to invite their parents or invite their siblings or invite their nieces and nephews? And who should be allowed to come in? And should those people be automatically granted some sort of, you know, direct path to getting legal status because of their connections to somebody else who's here? So those are among the debates in terms of what immigration should look like. It's why it's not so simple as just giving DACA recipients legal status, even though everybody can agree that they may deserve it. There's always something more that each side politically is trying to gain to come up with a more comprehensive immigration bill.
I mean, I would just try and unpack this question a little bit. I think given the dynamics of the current illegal immigration phenomena in the United States, mostly coming from Mexico and Central America, there's no question that there's a racial correlation to the opposition to illegal immigration. I think that's a different statement than saying there's a racist correlation. It's not an accident that the opposition to illegal immigration is tied to the large groups of people who are coming here illegally. We don't have large illegal immigration from Norway, and there's not, therefore, a large outcry against illegal immigration from Norway or from Canada, for that matter. So the correlation is not necessarily causation. Are there some racists on the anti-immigration side of the fight? Yes. Are there racists on the other side of the fight? Yes. All right. But is that the main driving force? No. We have, in the first time in world history, a third world economy with a large border, with a first world economy, with a large welfare state that provides an unbelievable magnet for illegal immigration. And the question is, on a rule of law, who decides how much immigration we can afford to have to assimilate without undermining or altering the nature of our body politic? The constitutional authority to address that policy question is assigned to Congress. Illegal immigration says we're going to take that policy judgment away from Congress and make it individually on our own. And so I think these policy arguments are better directed to Congress. When you allow illegal immigration, you undermine the policy judgment that they've made. Whether they've made it right or wrongly, And I think they've gotten it wrong. I think they've got too many hurdles for legal immigration. But the policy judgment, Constitution assigns to Congress. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, because when you have 11 or 22 million, probably more likely 22 million, illegal immigration, how do you have a policy judgment about the right level of immigration that we can absorb at any given time when you've got 22 million people who have come in addition to that policy judgment, right? And so the question is a legal and constitutional one. Where is the sovereign judgment going to be exercised? And I think that's in Congress, which means illegal immigration thwarts the judgments that have been made.
I mean, I have one thing to say. I mean, I just came back from the border, literally, came straight here. And I will concede that 9 out of 10 of the families who I met would not win an asylum claim. But every single one of them said that they were coming to this country to work. There's not one who said that they were coming here to avail of benefits. Moreover, undocumented immigrants cannot receive benefits. Yes, maybe they'll show up at the emergency room, and yes, they will have American children. But, to say that they are going to become public charges is, I don't think, accurate.
No, that's just not true. Because they are getting free public education, they are getting free health care, they are getting free AFDC. Nobody in any of those offices checks their immigration status when they walk in the door. So the amount of access to our welfare state system is huge. The Plyler versus Doe case, Supreme Court case, says they're entitled to free public education. That's a huge benefit. So there is a huge draw for the welfare state. Not the welfare office, although there's a draw there as well, because nobody, go to any welfare office and ask, do you check people's immigration status before you provide the forms for benefits? And the answer is no. They never, in fact, oftentimes they're directed not to ask. In California, it's illegal for them to ask.
Okay, but I think there's a moral question here, it's not just about legality. I think there's the moral question, because you mentioned, the majority of immigrants maybe aren't from Norway. But again, when you have circumstances in certain countries that are driving the migration to the U.S., I think that's something that perhaps should be considered. And I'm not here to argue one way or another, but I do think that that is part of the discussion. I mean, Norway may not have the same circumstances as the countries that people are coming from that are south of the U.S. border, from El Salvador, from Honduras, from Guatemala, where they are enduring extreme poverty, extreme violence.
Climate change,
and
by the
you
way.
Talk to these... You do talk to these families who are coming, and I've talked to the former Department of Homeland Security Secretaries, Jay Johnson and Janet Napolitano, and they'll tell you, and as parents, you probably can understand this too, that a lot of it is driven by parents' desire to have a better life for their children or just to save their children's life. If that is the driving factor for these families, if you're a parent, you don't really care if you're coming to the U.S. and are going to be put into jail if you're just trying to survive. And so that's one of the questions about, when it comes down to who should be allowed into the U.S., that's part of the conversation.
Right, and I'd like to point out that immigration from Mexico is at a net negative now. Circumstances on the ground in Mexico have changed dramatically. The fertility rate has dropped. And, so family size is much smaller. There's more economic opportunity there, and there's a lot less motivation to come to this country. Now, as she's pointed out, the conditions on the ground in Guatemala in particular have only become worse in recent years because of climate change. The land is less productive. I heard one migrant after the other say that they had been eking out an existence planting, coffee or maize beans, and that no longer was their land as productive, and they were having a hard time thus feeding their family. The fertility rate in Guatemala is still substantially higher than it is in Mexico. This wave of immigration has seen very few people from El Salvador. Why? The fertility rate there is approaching replacement level. And so those people are less motivated to come. There's less need. So I think that there are other issues that are influencing migration, and they are definitely not just the desire to exploit our welfare system or the kindness of our services. In terms of educating these children, I think that it's we're better off as a country if we have 5, 6, and 7-year-olds who are coming here to have them in school, because, yes, it is possible that those 5, 6, and 7-year-olds will be allowed to stay here long term, and what's better for us as a country, to educate them or to leave them uneducated?
And it is a myth that... It is a myth that undocumented immigrants are taking American jobs. There are currently, according to the latest government statistics, 6 million jobs remain unfilled currently here in the United States because they don't have enough qualified workers. And so there are a lot of jobs and a lot of companies that need more people to fill their jobs.
They also need a lot of low-skilled labor. You know, landscapers here in Colorado don't know what to do because they cannot find enough workers. They're going bananas asking for more of these so-called H-2B visas, which enable them to, bring guest workers. But because of the timing in terms of when they can, they need the workers and when they can request them, they are losing out to folks like Donald Trump who can ask for them earlier in the season. But by then, the 33,000 that are available of these visas have already been taken. So, they've added another 33,000 a couple of days ago to this year's allotment. But again, it's one of those things that only Congress can fix. I think, bottom line is, from what everybody here is saying, it's only proof that the system is so broken, and, we have a Congress that has been so dysfunctional and unable to meet in the middle to address this issue, and currently with an administration that is so averse to any concessions, it seems. I don't know what Jared Kushner is trying to do in the alleys, but I don't know what the prospects are for fixing this problem.
We just have 3 minutes left in this session. Thank you, all of you, for so many good questions. I will allow the panelists to close out with any remarks they'd like to make in closing.
Oh, am I start? Okay. Look, I don't disagree with many of the policy arguments that have been made here. My point has always been those arguments should be aimed at Congress. Because if Congress doesn't change the law, the constitutional authority to decide the right mix of immigration and labor force and all of that, that was assigned to Congress, it ends up being ignored. And you end up unilaterally handing to Guatemala the decision on what our immigration policy ought to be. And that means we are undermining the very notion of sovereignty. My point is, if you think that there are problems with the policy judgment that Congress has made, then let's change the policy judgment, not ignore it and undermine the very notion of the rule of law that has made us so successful in the first place. I think that's true for the DACA and DAPA. I think it's true for immigration more broadly. And as I've argued, I think it's also true on the birthright citizenship question. The legal issue here needs to drive the policy debate, not the other way around. Otherwise, we undermine the very notion of the rule of law that has made us successful and the magnet for immigration the world over.
I'll start where Professor Eastman started, which, as I said, is that we both believe in institutions, and we both believe that the question of who gets to decide these questions is important. I would agree with a lot of the statement that Congress, that is to say, again, Congress as a representative of all of you as the people, has a responsibility to decide what the laws of this nation shall be. I felt people cringe when I used the word institutional racism. I would not balk if we're looking at a history of immigration law that included the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 1980s that took until 1965, a year after the Civil Rights Act, to take away a blanket national origin quota for China, many other Asian countries, including my family. Those are racist laws. There is a causal link between those racist laws and the outcomes they produced. What I will say, I will back up a little bit for the contemporary context just to put one issue on the country because I think this is an important choice, an issue for all you to think about. Our laws may be less racist than they once were, but laws don't dictate outcomes. There are choices that policymakers make every day about which parts of the law they're going to enforce. Which parts are they going to take seriously? For a very wide variety of circumstances, there are more people who want to come to the United States than there are currently slots for, as the discussion goes. The government makes a decision about which of those people they're going to target for enforcement. Because the reality is, no matter what the appetite is of Congress to assign the largest budgets that can be imagined to immigration enforcement, you still can't deport every single undocumented immigrant in the United States. And that's where you make choices. You decide whether you want to have positive equities that take into account these notions of morality that my other panelists have mentioned. For example, a child who came so young that they didn't consciously participate in that decision. A parent who would leave a child in an extreme, exceptional, unusual hardship. You can decide if that's where you want to focus your resources or if you actually do want to focus them on cases of enemy combatants, murderers, rapists, terrorists, things like that. And so that, I think, is missing from the discussion. And in the decision to either allow everybody to be a priority or to let low-priority people be a priority, that's where I think you end up with the chaos we have. A decision to not enact any priorities is to make everybody a priority, and it produces the kind of chaos that we're seeing at the border.
And I'll just add, we all have some power. Every person in this room has power, and that is your voting power. And when you talk about Congress needing to make the decision, needing to make new laws in order to fix the problem in the broken system as it exists today, think back to the Gang of Eight bill in 2013, when a bipartisan majority in Congress, in the Senate, passed a bill that would have boosted border barriers, would have increased employees of ICE and Border Patrol at the borders in order to have more enforcement, that would have invested in new technologies, including surveillance and sensors and screeners for, you know, making sure people and cargo that's coming across the U.S. border belong in this country, and would have provided a pathway to legal status for undocumented citizens known as the Dreamers. Would have also established a merit-based point immigrant admission system. That passed 68-32 in the U.S. Senate. It was never brought up for a vote in the House because of politics. So who you put into power, who you elect as your representative matters. So think about that going into 2020.
Thank you to the panelists, and thank you to all of you.